It's Friday, October 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello, glad you're with us. Coming up, Russia fires cruise missiles as Syria's army mounts an offensive. We have reaction.
This is more an agreement, but between two parties that really can't seem to agree on much when it comes to cybersecurity.
How deep does the new U.S.-China cybersecurity agreement go? Also ahead, oil prices begin to move. We'll tell you which way. A U.S. music institution celebrates a big birthday. It's all on today's International Edition. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, ahead of a meeting of alliance defense ministers in Brussels Thursday, said they will discuss what he calls Russia's troubling escalation of military activity in Syria. Russia's first airstrikes were launched September 30th. Stoltenberg says given Russian incursions into Turkish airspace, NATO is able and ready to defend all allies, including Turkey, against any threat. Ankara is a member of the alliance. The NATO leader says the situation is being assessed constantly. Stoltenberg's remarks follow Russia's use of shipborne cruise missiles for the first time on Wednesday to attack what Moscow calls Islamic State targets. Meanwhile, Syrian troops with backing from Russian warplanes and Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia launched an offensive aimed at opposition forces in western Syria. Turkey's prime minister has said that only two of Russia's airstrikes have been aimed at IS targets. In Washington Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Russia's intervention has done little to bring the nearly five-year conflict to an end.
What Russian military activity has done, or has the potential to do, is to exacerbate the conflict already ongoing inside Syria along sectarian lines. And as we've said before, that if there's a constructive role to be had by Russia against ISIL, then that's a conversation we're willing to have. I don't think we're at that point right now, given what they're hitting and what they're choosing to do with their military forces. But if what they're doing, and certainly if you look just intrinsically at where they're striking and who they're going after, certainly would lead one to conclude that what they're trying to do is to prop up the Assad regime. All that's going to do is prolong the conflict. In fact, make it worse. And that is not something that we're interested in furthering and having a dialogue in terms of Russian future activity.
Kirby also said no decision has been made on establishing a no-fly zone along the Turkish-Syria border. Regional analyst Zubair Iqbal, a scholar at the Washington-based Middle East Institute, told VOA's Victor Beatty that Russia's objectives in Syria have not changed.
The whole purpose was eliminate all opposition to the Assad government, strengthen Assad government's position, and then, from position of strength, negotiate, if necessary, in Geneva. While the intention is to strengthen the hands of the Assad government, at the same time, the Russians are trying to send a message. The message is, we have now come back to a position of strength where we can attack positions from this far away, and we are willing and able to take the chances and the risks that are required to do it. So we have to look at it in a much wider sense than just looking at it from a narrow Syrian point of view. I concede and I agree that the purpose there clearly was soften up the fixed positions of the opposition, including of Islamic State, and then move in. But remember, Idlib and Amma are not necessarily places where the ISIS or the Islamic State is highly concentrated. It is really the other opposition groups which are concentrated. The point is, weaken them, and after you have weakened them and have forced them to combine and join with the Assad government position, then go after the Islamic State. It's a very risky proposition.
Is that going to unravel U.S. policy of backing these anti-Assad opposition fighters?
The realities on the ground are much more complex today than they were, say, 2 weeks ago. One of the important things is that the position of the opposition, especially the secular opposition and the opposition which could call the moderate opposition, has been weakened. And at this stage, they are not being provided the adequate military and political support that is needed for them to withstand it. which could very well then mean that Islamic State could very well take advantage of this position and move in areas which have now been vacated or weakened because of the Russian attacks. So we have to see how things go. It's all very confusing, all very complex at this moment. But what we can say, though, is that the Russians and their supporters of the Assad government have moved with a resolute force. Whether that turns out to be the right thing to do and whether it brings about what they expect it to bring about is anybody's guess. But my concern in this is the following. In case this fails, then we have a much more serious problem on our hands where the international intervention will have been considered as futile, as useless, and under those circumstances, the Islamic State's hand will be strengthened.
Turkey's airspace has been violated a number of times by Russian warplanes. How alarmed is Turkey?
Very alarmed, and for two reasons. One of those is, of course, that their territory and their sovereignty has been violated. But other thing which one has to be very careful about is the following. Turkey depends up to 50% of its gas needs, natural gas needs, from Russia. If it creates a situation where Russia and the conflict between Russia and Turkey takes place, then Turkey could potentially lose access, if not all, a part of that gas, the same way as Russia played its hands and its cards in the case of Ukraine. So under those circumstances, Turkey has to be very careful. And that would imply that it may actually play a much more cautious game than one would have expected Turkey to do.
Zubair says Russian backing should help improve both morale and recruiting for the Syrian army, which up to now has been on the defensive. He says if the army improves, it will likely mean the need for using Russian ground troops in the form of advisors and volunteers will lessen. We turn to online reactions to the Russian airstrikes aimed at Syria. As always, our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What is the U.S. reaction to this?
Well, we just heard from John Kirby, the State Department spokesperson, and the U.S. Embassy in Syria is tweeting his quotes. The embassy is on Twitter at U.S. Embassy Syria and sent out two tweets quoting Kirby, and the first one reads like this. Over 90% of the strikes that we have seen Russians take to date have not been against ISIL or Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. And here's a second tweet. Russian strikes have been largely against opposition groups that want a better future for Syria and don't want to see Assad regime in power.
Well, what about Kirby himself? Did he tweet at all today?
No, he hasn't. He's on Twitter at StateDPTSpokes, but he hasn't sent out any tweets in the last couple of days.
Well, it seems that the U.S. government is showing stronger stances against the Russian military actions in Syria. Are there any other tweets, G?
Well, that appears to be the case, but some politicians are still quite upset with what they perceive as lukewarm or slow response from Washington, and Senator John McCain is one of them.
And a pretty vocal one, too, I'm sure.
Absolutely. He sent out two tweets about the incident, and here's one. U.S. aircraft ordered to avoid Russian fighter aircraft in Syria, not the other way around. He's on Twitter at Senator John McCain. Now, our Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb also sent out a tweet quoting McCain, and she wrote, Senator McCain, hyphen, Putin bombs U.S.-backed opposition groups in Syria and the U.S. does nothing. This is not just harmful to our interests, it is immoral. The White House or President Obama have not tweeted about it yet.
Well, thanks as always for being here, G. She's on Twitter, by the way, at G. Abby Lee. And, of course, VOA's International Editions team is at VOA_IE. We hope you follow both of those accounts. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. One of the most anticipated outcomes of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent state visit to the United States was an agreement between the two countries to cooperate more closely on cybersecurity and put a halt to economic espionage online. Some analysts are questioning whether that deal can deliver what it promises. Doug Bernard covers the cyber world for VOA and has written about this for our website, voanews.com, and he speaks about it with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
When the announcement was first made, it had all the trappings of a big event. There was President Obama and President Xi Jinping on the lawn of the White House touting this agreement. President Obama said this is progress, although both leaders said more needs to be done. It all sounded great, at least on paper. Well, when people actually began looking at the paper and at the framework agreement, or common understanding, as it's officially called, they found that there's really not a lot of there. This is more a agreement, but between two parties that really can't seem to agree on much when it comes to cybersecurity.
Well, how can you actually monitor this sort of thing?
Well, that's a very good question. The United States is particularly concerned about economic espionage. Now, we all know that sort of traditional espionage, government to government, goes on and everybody just sort of winks at it. But the United States is very concerned about hacks they say are coming from China, and some government officials have alleged that Chinese officials are helping prosecute the theft of intellectual property. That doesn't sound like much, but these are business industry secrets that are worth tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars. The United States wants to end it. But the problem is, one of the big problems is it's very hard in the world of cyber to know where an attack is coming from, much less who is definitely behind it. So before you go pointing fingers or imposing sanctions on countries or other actions, you really have to know for sure and kind of lay out for the public that government X or industry Y is behind the hack. It's very, very difficult to do.
Well, you often come in and talk to me about hackers, but it always seems like somehow, some way, eventually, these hackers are able to get around things,
yes.
Firewalls and things like that.
Yes.
So how is this enforceable?
Well, this is another element I think that some analysts that we've been talking to are very concerned about. For there to be an enforcement mechanism, there needs to be some sort of idea of retaliation. Here are lines that we will not cross. And if you cross them, we will do this or that or some such. This agreement doesn't have any of that out there. And it also kind of lays bare one of the I think larger secrets that is that the definition of cybersecurity that China has and the United States have are very, very different. So I think what you have here is a very basic, a fundamental difference of opinion about what cybersecurity is. Until there can be a meeting of the minds on that, it's hard to see how any agreement's going to have much teeth in it.
VOA's Doug Bernard speaking with International Edition host Susan Yaki. We go from cybersecurity to the open markets where oil prices are starting to go up. To explain why, we're joined by VOA economics reporter Alexis Christophorus from New York.
Oil prices climbed to their highest in 3 months after a closely watched oil forecaster predicted prices would climb to $75 over the next 2 years. Pyra Energy Group, which correctly predicted the collapse in oil prices a year ago, said it sees crude at $70 a barrel by the end of next year and $75 a barrel in 2017. Brent crude closed up $1.72 at $53.05 a barrel, while U.S. crude futures closed up $1.62 at $49. $79.43 a barrel. Earlier, crude prices climbed on the heels of a 3% rise in Chinese stock markets after a week-long holiday. Oil also got a boost after Syrian troops and allied militia backed by Russian airstrikes and cruise missiles attacked rebel forces. Traders believe that situation could potentially impact the flow of oil from the region. Jim?
Alexis, I understand we now have in our possession the minutes from the September meeting of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Do they provide any clues about a possible interest rate hike in the future?
Unfortunately, no new news on that front. The Federal Reserve officials did put off an interest rate increase in September because of growing risks to their outlook for economic growth and inflation, mainly from China, even as they continue to say they were on track to raise the target later this year. The FOMC noted that domestic economic conditions, including data on consumer spending and housing, had continued to improve, and the labor market had reached or was close to the committee's long-run estimates for unemployment. Still, concerns over China and its potential spillover to other economies were, quote, likely to depress U.S. net exports and cause further strengthening of the dollar, which could damp inflation in the U.S. And, of course, some analysts are now pushing the possibility of a rate hike into 2016 following last week's weaker-than-expected September unemployment report. Jim?
Ah, the mystery and intrigue and guessing of when a rate hike might take place, but no guessing when it comes to Alexis Christophorus bringing us the latest details in economics. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jim.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
A legendary country music venue in Nashville, Tennessee, has just celebrated its 90th birthday. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about this milestone.
Well, if you've heard of legends such as Loretta Lynn, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, many of these country music icons' work has been promoted to the world via a radio show called the Grand Ole Opry. Well, now this small radio show grew into a major concert venue and cultural institution, and this past week it celebrated its 90th birthday with all of the big stars in country music. VOA's Nikki Strong is here to talk with us about it. Nikki, how did it get so huge?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small radio show back in 1925, and it was founded by George Hay. And it was a live radio show that featured performances from different country artists. It still airs on WSM AM, which had a huge signal, and it enabled the show to reach an exponentially large audience beyond Nashville, Tennessee. And in the process, it became a huge player in exposing and introducing the world to country music. And the Grand Ole Opry, as a consequence, is credited with helping to shape and define the actual genre. And in the process, it's become a source of inspiration for anyone who wants to perform in country music. Reba McEntire, who said she went to a Grand Ole Opry performance before she was a teenager. Oh. And she saw it and said, I want to do that. And look where she is now. So it's been incredible. And Grand Ole Opry has become the pinnacle of a lot of country artist careers. To be inducted and asked to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry is like being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's selective, it's elitist, and it's a huge, huge honor.
And now it's moved around a lot, too. It's had six homes in 90 years.
Yeah. I think by the time I'm 90, I probably will have moved about six times at least as well. It has had six homes. At first, it was at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company back in 1925. And then it moved several times between 1934 and 1943. It landed at the Ryman Auditorium before it actually settled into its current Grand Ole Opry House in March 1974. I think one of the cool things about it is that when it moved from the Ryman to its current location, a 6-foot circle of oak was cut from the stage at Ryman and inserted into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry. So by preserving a piece of the Ryman stage, generations of country music singers can perform on the wood where their legendary predecessors
performed.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
A lot of memories there.
Yeah.
Well, is it just country music artists that have performed at the Grand Ole Opry?
No, actually, I mean, it's primarily a country music venue. That is its claim to fame, and that's where it's committed. But actors and actresses and other singers as well have graced the stage. President Richard Nixon, actually, was at the Grand Ole Opry, as well as actor Kevin Bacon, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, just to name a few.
Yeah, quite a variety of performers or visitors there. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. You can also hear her on VOA's Country Hits USA. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Elvira. Elvira. My heart's on fire. Elvira.
You've been listening to International Edition. We are always found at our website, voanews.com, each and every day. Stop by when you have a chance. We're also on Twitter. You can follow us at @VOA_IE, also around the clock. We thank you for joining us, as we thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In too many countries around the world, criminals have built great empires on laundered funds to infiltrate and corrupt government institutions. In this shadowy illegal economy, said David Luna of the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, traffickers and narcotics kingpins act as CEOs and venture capitalists while they build their empires of destruction. These illicit activities have taken over a significant chunk of the world economy. According to various international organizations, the illegal economy accounts for 8 to 15% of the world gross domestic product. And in many developing countries, it may account for higher percentages in their economies. The World Trade Organization estimates that the value of counterfeit and pirated goods alone is equivalent to some 7% of the world's merchandise. This darker side of global trade is thriving with hundreds of billions of dollars in illicit commerce that includes trafficking in narcotics, persons, and endangered wildlife, among other goods and commodities. Simply put, illicit trade is an obstacle to shared prosperity by breeding corruption and siphoning capital and human resources away from legitimate economic activity. The best way to combat illegal trade is through collective action. This includes strengthening cross-border cooperation to tackle illicit commerce and help communities to seize the benefits of open trade to achieve sustainable development and security. Country implementation of the WTO's Trade Facilitation Agreement will play a critical role in this process. The United States will continue to enhance international cooperation with key partners to combat the lethal nexus of organized crime, illicit trade, corruption, and money laundering, and to protect communities from the violence, harm, and exploitation brought about by transnational networks. The U.S. will do this by enhancing its efforts to break their corruptive power, attacking their financial underpinnings, following the money and stripping them of their illicit wealth, and severing their access to the financial system. At a time when global risks are growing and converging, the international community must come together and build its own network to stand up to and defeat the dark world of illicit trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.